Welcome to this week's episode of The Thatcher Effect, a top 10 Utah Utes podcast. In my last episode, I made a passing remark of the Marvel villain Thanos, and how the Utes would have a gauntlet ahead of them in USC, Oregon, and Washington. Utah was able to make some magic in LA against the Trojans, but the Ducks were too much for the overhyped Utes last Saturday. What went so wrong in Utah's first home loss in 18 games, and what would their next contest against ASU look like? Plus, there have been rumors that Rising wants to transfer. Is that a good move for him? And the first four conference schedules for the new Big 12 were released yesterday. Do the Utes have an easier path to the playoff? Let's discuss right now on The Thatcher Effect. Hey Thatcher Effect fans, this episode is brought to you by Homefield, the premium college apparel on the market. This is by far the most comfortable gear you'll wear to a Utah game all year. Even better than that, first-time buyers get 15% off of their first purchase. Just use code VARIETYSPORTS, no space, and you'll get that 15% discount on some awesome throwback Utes gear. That's code VARIETYSPORTS. Let's get to this week's headlines. Number 13th-ranked Utah football lost to 8th-ranked Oregon on Saturday, 35-6 at Rice-Eccles Stadium. The Utes didn't seem to bring the physicality at all, and it showed throughout the entire game. The lone bright spot from the loss was wide receiver Devon Vele, who had 7 receptions for 80 yards. We'll see if he can become more involved in the game against the Sun Devils this coming Saturday. Bo Nix absolutely dealed in the first half and finished 24-31 for 248 yards and 2 touchdowns. Nix, in my opinion, should be at the top of the Heisman voting race after last week's performance and Washington's struggle over the last few weeks against the bottom of the conference. The first college football playoff poll was released on Tuesday, and once again, 6 teams from the conference found themselves in the rankings. That's about the number that I predicted earlier in the season. Washington and Oregon lead the way at 5-6, which is interesting considering that they probably have a better resume than Michigan or Georgia, but I guess that's how they're going to rank it. Probably Georgia and Michigan could be better teams, right? But the whole thing about the college football playoff committee is who's most deserving because of their resume. And in my opinion, Oregon and Washington have, besides Ohio State, the best resumes in those top teams in the country. Oregon State comes in next in the conference, ranked at 16th. Utah follows them at 18, UCLA's at 19, and USC moves up to 20. These rankings are a very accurate representation of the discrepancy in talent level among the Pac-12 programs right now. The Ducks and the Huskies are a clear cut above everyone else, while the Tier 2 teams are solid top 20 programs, maybe besides Arizona. I think they're in that top, or in that Tier 2 as well, but they're just not ranked because of their record. Now let's go over last week's Pac-12 games, and I'll tell you what I took away from each contest. First game was 24th-ranked USC beating Cal 50-49 in Berkeley. What a game. In my opinion, after watching this contest, Utah may have broken USC, especially their defense. And now I know the USC defense has never been great. You know that that's my take. It's been that way for the last 2 years. But this defense gave up 500 yards to the Bears offense. Now, Cal, in my opinion, is similar to ASU in the fact that they are competing in a lot of these games. They're not blowouts, right? They're able to make all these games against these tier two, tier one teams. Like, they're able to make it a contest. But the fact that Cal was beating USC by 2 scores for most of the game, and they had to push a giant comeback to win it, and by 1, because Cal tried to pull a Utah from 2022, go for 2 at the end of the game, get the win. I think that was a good call. Just not a great execution on the 2-point conversion, right? But this USC defense is bad, okay? And if Alex Grinch has a job at the end of this year, if Lincoln Riley does in fact stay in LA, that's going to be extremely surprising to me and may reflect on how Lincoln Riley likes to lead his programs. Now, I understand that he has his favorites. He's similar to other coaches in the conference, Coach Prime. But you have to realize that for the betterment of your program, you need to let go of your defensive coordinator. It's just not working out. His schemes are consistently flawed. He's getting taken advantage of not only by the top programs of the conference, but now by the bottom of the conference, okay? So I'm really interested to see, because of what has happened these last few weeks with USC and with Washington, I think that game becomes very interesting this weekend in the Coliseum. Caleb's still playing great. I don't think he's completely eliminated himself from the Heisman conversation, but this game against the Huskies is going to prove vital to both the Heisman race and the Pac-12 race, because USC is saying they still want to get to the Pac-12 title game. They still think that they have a shot as a two-loss team to get to the CFP, which is wild considering that they still got a gauntlet ahead of them and they just don't look near enough to being a top four team in the country. Like I said, Cal is competing in their games, but I'm not sure that the lack of wins and the lack of completing games will keep Justin Wilcox with his head coach position. I said that he was on the hot seat earlier in the year, and even with them competing with these tier two teams in the conference, I just don't see that that is enough for him to keep moving forward. So let's see what Cal does, maybe even in the season or after the season, with Justin Wilcox as the head coach. Fifth-ranked Washington beat Stanford 42-33 in Northern California, Palo Alto. Stanford has also been competitive in most of their games. And like ASU, like Cal, but I think the difference between Cal and Stanford is that this will keep Taylor his job, and it's giving them a little bit of momentum that they're staying in games, right? Stanford was going to be the clear-cut least favorite of the conference moving into this season. And the fact that they were able to beat Colorado in a huge come-from-behind victory, that they're able to keep up with Washington, right? This is proving great for Troy Taylor and his program. I love that man. I think he's a great coach. It's just a matter of them getting over the certain bumps in the road that are kind of halting them from being able to compete in recruiting and NIL. But Stanford, I like the way that they're setting up their program. I like the players that they always recruit. It's just a solid, solid team. Now, on the other hand, the Huskies have now struggled against both ASU and Stanford, the two worst teams in the league. And keep in mind that if ASU would have kicked a field goal, had they had enough offensive linemen to block, per Kenny Dillingham, they just said they didn't have enough offensive linemen to even attempt a field goal. Right, if they make a field goal, ASU wins that game in Seattle. And then Stanford went for it on fourth down when it was a one-score game, or I believe it was tied, or they were down two. And a great drawn-up play by Troy Taylor, right? Had a few fakes and a sweep route with an extra pass. Guys wide open, just drops the pass 15 yards down the field. They lose the game. So if they complete that, Stanford has a great shot of winning the game, right? So the Huskies have proven to be beatable now, right? In a time earlier in the season where I thought that they didn't really have a big chink in their armor, they might have one now. And so that's why I'm saying that this game against USC has become much more interesting because of both of these defenses, the struggles of the Washington offense. I'm really looking forward to that game in LA this weekend. That's going to prove vital in maybe who ends up going to the Pac-12 championship game, because I think Oregon, after how they performed against Utah and Salt Lake, is a solid, solid pick to be able to make it to Vegas. Now, who's going to be that other team that gets there, right? Now, with Washington, they've got some great teams ahead of them that they have to face, right? They've got USC this week. They've got Oregon State next week. Oregon State in 2 weeks. They've got Utah next week. Like, this is going to be tough. And so let's see how the Huskies can handle a little bit of adversity. And if they get out of that unscathed, of course, I believe they should be able to make it to Vegas. 23rd ranked UCLA beat Colorado 28-16 at the Rose Bowl. I don't think this really had much to say about UCLA. This was more to say about Colorado. Now, I know the talk of the town was that they got robbed mid-game. A lot of the players lost their jewelry. I don't know if that's God trying to show them a sign to humble them. Could very well be. But this was more proof that Colorado just does not have the talent turnaround to make it to a bowl game this year. A lot of the hype at the beginning of the season was, Deion Sanders is proving that you can turn around a program through the transfer portal in only one offseason. And it was so drastic because Colorado was most likely and by far the worst Power 5 team in the country last year. And the fact that they started off, I believe it was 4-2, was incredible, right? And everyone's like, okay, well, maybe you can do this, right? You can take the worst program in the country and you can turn them into a top 25 team in just an offseason. No, you can't. And that definitely proves in physicality and the trenches. But Deion's comment on his offensive line post-game when he mentions, yeah, we just don't have a good offensive line. I have to get better players next year. Like, dude, you're in the middle of the season. And you're basically just saying, yeah, my players suck. I just need to get new ones. That's just how it is. Like, how do you think they want to play for you? Like, It just doesn't make any sense. I've had conversations with players that have left Deion's program, and stuff going on behind the scenes is way worse than what it's seeming to be on the outside. And although I probably can't make comments here, like, you just have to know that the toxic level in Colorado might be worse than what we're making it out to be. I love the idea of, hey, work for what you got, come here to this program, let's turn this program around, I'm happy for the fans, right? But you have to do it in a healthy way. And that's the reason why coaches like Jed Fish, Kenny Dillingham, they're trying to reflect Kyle Whittingham's program. They've both come outright and said that. And I think you're seeing that now with Jed Fish in year three. He's already proving to be, wow, Arizona's coming up and up. They're going to be a good program. ASU has been fighting with a terrible roster. They've been able to keep games competitive all year long. That's the type of program that they want to reflect, and it's proving to be successful. Coach Prime, on the other hand, not so much. I'm interested to see how his team responds in their final games because of his comments, especially if they're not bowl eligible, right? If Shadur wants to even play, if they're not even going to make it to a bowl game, if Travis Hunter wants to do the same, let's just see what they do, because I think that's going to be very interesting come the end of the year. ASU beat Washington State 38-27. I mean, what the heck? Washington State was an undefeated 4-0 team in the top 20, and now they've lost four in a row. I mean, their downfall should be under investigation right now by the FBI. The lack of rushing attack from the Cougars, in my opinion, is what is putting Cam Ward under too much pressure at quarterback, and he might not have arrived as we all thought he did at the beginning of the year. I mentioned before the season that a lot of hype has been around Ward and that he proved flashes last year, but that this was the year to prove he could be that consistent elite-level quarterback. And now, after a four-game losing streak, he's going back to that flashy mode, and I think that's because they're not able to run the ball. I mean, he's throwing 50 pass attempts per game. It's just not doable, right? And so Washington State now fighting for bowl eligibility when they still got some good games ahead of them. Really sad. Now, in terms of ASU, this will come later in my keys to the game, but Scadaboo is a scary threat to any defense that he faces. And in my opinion, he should be the Utes' number one priority come Saturday afternoon. Arizona upsets 11th-ranked Oregon State 27-24 in Tucson. I have not a lot to say except I called it. You heard it here first on the Thatcher Effect. Arizona was the game. Like, that was the game to look out for, and Arizona was the team to watch. They are much better than what a lot of people predicted them to be. I said they were going to be a bowl team when they came in, and as of right now, I think they will be. Wildcats are a Tier 2 team in the Pac-12. Their record does not reflect it. I mentioned that earlier in the headlines, but they're a Tier 2 team. They can beat anyone in the top and the bottom of those two tiers. Utah, as of right now, will lose in Tucson if they do not play like they did at USC. I had the Oregon State game and the Arizona game as dark horse losses come the beginning of the year. I can't remember what I said in my preseason episode, but I think that I predicted that Utah would lose in Tucson even if they did add a healthy roster. But Noah Fifita and company have proved to be such a tough play, especially in the desert. And in my opinion, they're going to be a force in the Big 12 next year if Fifita does stay and if they're able to upgrade at some positions on the defensive side of the ball. And in Oregon State, on the other hand of this game, still has a great chance of playing upset to Washington in Reser in a few weeks, and that should be an excellent game. Like, UCLA and Oregon State, they're kind of on the, you know, they're in that tier two, but they have the chance to upset both of the top teams in the country when they play them at the end of the year. 18th-ranked Utah will host ASU this Saturday for their Salute to Service game. The Utes are looking to start their next home streak with a much easier opponent in the Sun Devils, and that game will kick off at noon on the Pac-12 Network. The Running Utes got things underway with their exhibition game against Westminster. The shooting seems to have improved with the transfer portal addition of Cole Bajima. Brandon Carlson continues to improve year in and year out, and him playing at the power forward position could unlock some more potential out of him this year. It's unfortunate that Georgia Tech transfer Deion Smith has not received his eligibility from the NCAA yet, but if he does, this team does have 20-win capability. The Utes will open up their 2023-24 season against Eastern Washington on Monday at home at 7:30 Mountain on the Pac-12 Network. That's all for this week's headlines. Let's get to the main topics of today's show. Now, for a quick recap of what happened in the complete embarrassment of Utah against Oregon, I just want to go through some of my main notes of what I noticed being there in person for what was to be the big-time primetime game on Fox. And just unfortunate that we had to bring Gus Johnson, Joel Klatt, and even Colin Cowherd out here just to watch Utah not even be who they were. And that was my biggest thing that I mentioned in the headlines was the lack of physicality. Utah, it was going to be a long shot to beat Oregon, right? You needed to have them be a little bit off, which they clearly weren't. But in order for you to win, you needed to be at the best of your game, and you needed to be the most physical. And this is the big thing about playing emotional games in sports, especially if you're coming off of a back-to-back in the NBA, or you're doing it playing it the next week in football. There's just such an emotional high. It's hard to get going once again for an even better team, right? And I thought that them being at home would give them a slight advantage, but that just proved to not be important at all as Oregon took the life out of the crowd after their first drive. Oregon beat Utah very similar to what they did with an injured Bo Nix in Eugene last year. They played the quick passing game and they used the middle of the field. Now, last year, Bo Nix, he was injured, his leg was injured, and it frustrated me because I can't remember who called the game, but they were basically calling Bo Nix a god because he was able to throw 5-yard slants on his injured foot. Okay, great. So I don't know what makes him a god about that. I think any legitimate quarterback can make a 5-yard slant throw. But this was different, right? Because Utah's bringing extra pressure, right? And so Oregon's using the middle of the field, but Bo Nix was finding the eye of the needle. He was able to throw on all sides of the field against this Utah defense. And that meant he was able to find the extra space and get Oregon down the field in a quick and timely manner. They played up tempo. That is Utah's downfall. It's been their downfall for the entire year. It's made me frustrated because consistently when teams are playing no huddle offense against the Utes, Utah defense is consistently looking towards the sideline, trying to get their play in. And while they're looking to the sideline, the play starts. And sometimes we don't even have a corner on a slot receiver. We're throwing our linebacker out there to cover guys, and it's just frustrating. And so I think, although Scally is a fantastic defensive coordinator, I'm not saying that he's terrible by any means, but I think a measure to improve on is, can Utah defense be the same Utah defense against an up-tempo offense? Let's see if ASU tries to take advantage of that this weekend. Keep in mind, Kenny Dillingham, the head coach of the ASU Sun Devils, was the offensive coordinator for Oregon last year. He's the one who took advantage of Utah's defense last season. So, although ASU has a worse roster across the board, will the scheme be enough to keep them in the game in Salt Lake City? Possibly. Another great note from the time that Bo Nix had in the pocket was just that the Oregon offensive line is the best in the country. They have only allowed 4 sacks the entire season, 0 against the Utes. That says something, okay? This team is going to keep Bo Nix clean and healthy in the pocket. And if Bo Nix has a lot of time to throw, he's going to take advantage of it. And that's exactly what we saw against the Utes. Utah, in my opinion, also showed a flash of, and this is for you Jazz fans, a flash of Quinn Snyder, as they did not want to adjust on the offensive side of the ball. And I think this goes to Andy Ludwig. The 2-minute offense drill that they played at the end of the first half was the best that the offense looked the entire game. It wasn't even close. Utah was moving down the field. They were using the edges of the field, especially with Devon Vele. They were throwing in play action passes, using that Andy Ludwig special, right? And although they weren't able to get into the end zone, they were able to go down the field, kick a field goal, make it a 2-possession game. Now, then they came out in the second half and just went back to, okay, halfback draw up the middle. Oh, low to the box, 1-yard gain. Dang it. Okay, let's try a 5-yard slant with our wide receivers. Low to the box. Can't use the middle of the field. Let's just throw an interception. Like, it was frustrating. The 2-minute offense was keeping Oregon on their heels because this is something they had not seen all year. Andy Ludwig, once again, was able to pull out all the stops. And so they were able to drive down the field. And the fact that they weren't using that in the second half was bamboozling. But then, even further, you get to post-game comments, you get to this week's comments in practice, and the players were like, yeah, we should have used that. We needed to use that. So did they talk about that in halftime and the coaching staff just didn't listen to the players? That seemed to trouble me just a little bit because of a seeming disconnect between the players and the coaches. clearly, and this was mentioned by Devon Vaylay and others, we needed to run a two-minute offense. That was working for us. We should have done it, and we did it. Okay? My guess is leaders like Devon probably spoke up at halftime and said, hey, maybe why don't we try that? So it's interesting that they didn't, and that just clearly proved to be Utah's funeral as Oregon stomped in them again in the third quarter and put the game away with 20 minutes left in the game. Now, Utah will need to play with tempo this week if they want to play better. I think that's the key to taking this Utah offense with Bryson Barnes as its leader to the next level. I think Rising is able to play a slowed down version of the offense because he knows the plays so well. He knows the offense so well. It allows him to read the defenses even more. That's what makes him so good, right? And we'll talk about that when we talk about the Cam Rising transfer news in a few minutes. But with Bryson Barnes, I think up-tempo is not bad, right? I think it keeps teams on the heels. I think it allows for your running game to thrive and benefit off of play action, which is Utah's bread and butter. So in my opinion, and this will also be a key to the game against ASU, you need to play up-tempo. And I think the two-minute drill should be a bigger part of this game against the Sun Devils, especially as you prepare to play Washington in Seattle the following week. You cannot be on a down week with your offense, no matter who you're playing against Washington, right? I know they've had down weeks against ASU and Stanford. But keep in mind, when ASU played them, they held that Washington offense to 7 points. Okay? So that's the ASU defense, right? That's with Tate Romney, the former BYU third and fourth string linebacker, leading that ASU defense against this Husky offense. So Utah has a way better team on paper, right? So they can do it, but will they? That'll be a key in a few weeks. And then last but not least, Bo Nix should be the Heisman frontrunner. And I think he would be had he beaten Washington a few weeks ago. But he's played consistent week in and week out. Now he's playing better competition. And although they lost at Washington, he played a fantastic game. I don't think he played a terrible game. He's the guy who really kept them in that one, despite the at sometimes poor play calling from Dan Lanning. And speaking of Lanning, just a little side note, if you guys have not watched the recap video from the Oregon football team against Utah, Oregon, this may be propaganda, right? You don't know the full picture, but if it is what it looks like, Oregon, you read Utah like they just read straight through them. There was nothing to it. They knew exactly what Utah was going to run. They took advantage of it. And that was impressive, to say the least. I'm not saying I'm the first guy to look at opposing teams' highlight reels after they beat Utah, but man, that was awesome. Like, Dan Lanning has completely outcoached Kyle Whittingham 2 years in a row, which is funny because it kind of creates this motion of who owns who in the Pac-12. Kyle Whittingham owns Lincoln Riley, but Dan Lanning owns Kyle Whittingham. But Kalen DeBoer owns Dan Lanning. So I just think it's interesting how Dan has had the best of Kyle these last few years. And although physicality, right, or toughness, grit, you could talk about that with Utah, it seems to play a part in their losses. I mean, they just got completely outcoached, like completely. And that was kind of fun to watch. I mean, not fun as a Utah fan seeing them lose, but interesting to see that they just read everything that Utah was going to try and do at him. Now, let's go to the next main topic of today's show. And that is Cam Rising potentially entering the transfer portal after this season. Now, I haven't heard this from Utah fans. I've only heard this from BYU fans, but I'm going to address it nonetheless because it could be a valid concern. National podcasts, apparently multiple, have now said that Cam Rising will and should transfer because of these three main reasons. The first, more NIL money. Why not? That's the number one reason of recruiting, and it should be, right? That's a great reason to come to a program. More NIL money is very well possible, especially at big-time programs, which is the second main reason that Cam Rising would be leaving. You go to a bigger brand and team, most likely in the SEC, right? There's teams out there on the East Coast that need a quarterback. Maybe looking at Alabama, right? Maybe looking at teams that are going to have graduating quarterbacks. And now you're like, well, what if Cam Rising went over there, right? They could still be a great team. There's no doubt about it. And as I mentioned in last time's episode, Cam Rising needs to come back to college because he needs to prove that he can effectively throw the deep ball. And you can very much go to an offense that uses the deep ball more to allow him to put that on film, right? Obviously, the Utah offense is not about throwing Hail Marys every three plays, but there are other offenses that are spread offenses that work well with throwing the deep ball that can allow him to put more tape on film than at Utah. Completely valid, right? But I think those are the only three reasons that Cam Rising would transfer. I just don't think, in my opinion, that it is a smart move by Rising, especially because of how I view the Utah starting quarterback. In my opinion, and I've said this multiple times before, Cam Rising is good because of this Utah offense. Rising does not have the natural quarterback ability to the likes of Caleb Williams or Michael Penix. The natural arm strength. He's got the scramble ability, sure. But I'm just talking about the natural quarterback arm strength. He does not have that. Cam Rising cannot throw an 80-yard, 70-yard pass like it's nothing. He's able to throw a deep ball, but it allows a little bit more effort, right? He is a good quarterback. He's a dog. He's a winner. The fact that Cam Rising has won two Pac-12 championships, and then you look at the quarterbacks that he had to go against to be there, that says something about them. He's a winner. That doesn't mean that he is a better quarterback. He is a winner. And I think that is because of this Utah scheme that he knows so well. Rising. He can read plays. He knows plays like the back of his hand. Andy Lug would call something, but he allows for Cam Rising to be free in the backfield to call checks plays. He's able to change plays in the backfield. And because of this, as I've mentioned hundreds and hundreds of times before, it allows Rising to read defenses easier, and therefore it makes him a better quarterback. If he transfers and goes to a different style of offense, there is a very good chance that that ability for Cam Rising goes away. Okay? And I understand that even if he doesn't prove to be as great of a natural quarterback as other transfer portal players would be, he is a winner and he is a dog. And programs are going to want that nonetheless. If he's a winner, he's a winner. And that's the main emphasis of your program. You just need to win. Cam Rising proves to be that guy. But I think it is solely because of his knowledge of this Utah offense. Now, NIL shouldn't be a problem with Utah, okay? I understand he could be making tens of millions of dollars more with another program. I just don't think that Cam is that type of person. And especially if he's making as much as estimated. Look, he's estimated to make up to between $750K and $1 million, okay? That's great money. And you're already with a winning program. And keep in mind, as we get into the next step of the episode, if he comes back next year, wide open path to the playoff. Wide open. There is no more recognition than going to the playoff, okay? I don't care what brand you're going to. If you go to the playoff, you will have all of the national attention and you're with your program. So I think those are the main reasons that also Cam Rising should stay. And I think he will. He could prove me wrong. I'm not saying he can't. But in my eyes, I just don't think that it makes sense for Cam Rising to transfer because he is only good because of this Utah offense. He's a good quarterback. He's not an elite quarterback. He is a good and great quarterback. I just think that's the difference. So we'll keep that in mind as, especially as the season winds to an end, the Cam Rising talk will ramp back up again. The Brant Keithy talk will ramp back up again. Keithy, it sounds like, is leaning more towards going to the NFL, but he could very well come back. Keithy's transfer wouldn't make sense because Utah's offense is one that runs through the tight end position. So if you want more film, if you need more film, you stay here because we're all about tight ends at Utah. So that just makes sense for Keithy. But we'll keep that on monitor as the season winds to an end. Now, big news this week is that the new Big 12 Conference released their 2024 through 2027 home and away schedules for each team. Now, of course, that includes Utah. And at first glance, it's just kind of like, dang, like there's no more big time programs like USC or Oregon or UCLA or Washington. And now you're kind of like, ah, I don't really like this. But I think that these programs will be on the up and up, and this will prove to be a great conference in football. Not fantastic, but it will be a good conference. Okay. So in 2024, Utah will play these following teams at home: Arizona, BYU, TCU, and Iowa State. that's a solid home schedule, especially once you add Baylor in there, right? But besides that, it'll be Baylor, SUU, and then most likely either a G5 team or another FCS team, because Utah needs to fill in the slot that BYU will now take up in conference play. So if you're a season ticket holder, I think you have some good games, okay? I think Arizona is going to be a good team. I think BYU's a good team. I think TCU is a good team, right? So you've got three solid home games. Now, Utah will have five road games in conference play. And this is, again, if teams will be better, but no really great teams that Utah has to face on the road at ASU, at Colorado, at Houston, at Oklahoma State, and at UCF, okay? I think the toughest game on that road schedule is Oklahoma State, maybe Colorado, okay? But Houston, UCF, you should walk right over them. ASU, you should definitely beat them with the team that you have coming back near next year, especially if Rising is returning. And these home teams, like, you should definitely beat all of them, okay? Utah should have no problem going undefeated at Rice-Eccles next year. And like I said, this is a wide-open path to the playoff. I think Utah could possibly lose one game, and I think that's on the road. I think that's either Colorado or I think that's Oklahoma State. But Utah should very clearly go undefeated at home. If they show up and show out every week, that should be an easy schedule. And so if you look at that, 11-1 with a returning Rising, maybe a returning Keithy, very doable. And with the expanded playoff, Utah's got a wide-open shot. Because besides Utah, and I think the next two tiers, right, Arizona, maybe Colorado, maybe Oklahoma State, right? Those are probably going to be the three teams now that are competing for a Big 12 title. That's very doable, okay? Utah has a good shot at going to the playoff next year if that happens. Okay, let's look at 2025. Home teams, ASU, Colorado, Texas Tech, Kansas State, Cincinnati. Okay, once again, I think that's going to be a solid year. ASU is going to be in year three under Kenny Dillingham. That'll be good. If Deion Sanders is there at Colorado, Coach Prime, then Colorado will be even better. Okay, those are two good teams. Texas Tech, proven to be a solid program. Kansas State is a top 20 program year in and year out. And Cincinnati, let's just see how they do. As of right now, they're the bottom of the conference. So overall, good home games. Okay, away games, BYU, Baylor, Kansas, and West Virginia. BYU and Kansas will be the formidable road opponents that year. But obviously, I think Kansas will probably be the one to look out for. But once again, like, a pretty easy schedule compared to what Utah's had to deal with in the Pac-12, right? West Virginia, Kansas, Baylor, BYU. Those are your road games. Like, okay, we can do that. Okay, let's look at 2026. Home games. BYU, Houston, Kansas, West Virginia. All completely winnable. Okay, as of right now, all completely winnable. That is a very easy home conference schedule. Road, Arizona, Colorado, TCU, Iowa State, Cincinnati. Once again, you're consistently playing Arizona and Colorado, TCU as well. But, you know, there's, besides that, there's nothing really there. Okay, 2027, Arizona, Baylor, TCU, Oklahoma State, UCF. Road games, ASU, BYU, Texas Tech, Kansas State. Now, the 2027, that's a tough road contest, in my opinion. Kansas State on the road is going to be tough. Texas Tech on the road is going to be tough. ASU on the road, I think by that time, will be a great game. And same with BYU. But as far as looking at these home conference schedules these next 4 years, Utah should go undefeated in all of these. I just don't think there's any question. I don't think they have any business losing any of those games as of right now. Kansas State could prove me wrong. Texas Tech could prove me wrong. Oklahoma State or TCU could prove me wrong in a few years, but I just don't think there's anything that holds Utah back. Like, this conference is wide open for the taking, which makes me extremely excited for what's to come for Utah football. So let's see how they schedule out this 2024 season for Utah, how they kind of put these home and away matchups. My belief is that they'll put BYU as the Thanksgiving slot in rivalry weekend as the last game of the regular season. Baylor, keep in mind, will still play Utah. That will be the second or third game of the year at home. Again, a winnable game because either Baylor is still going to be just not great or they're going to make a coaching transition from Dave Aranda and things will be better eventually for Baylor, but just not next year. So let's just see how it moves out. But as of right now, 2024 is looking great for a Utah playoff run. Now, to finish off this week's episode, let's go to this week's keys to the game against ASU. Now, I've got four once again, and I don't think Utah has to do all four to win the game, but if they do all four, I'll give my score prediction. My first one, and I said this was the priority when I was going through the headlines, is that you need to eliminate Scadaboo and hold him to under 80 yards of offense. This ASU running back is a big boy, and he's able to get big yards. He's able to shed tackles. He is the key to ASU opening up their playbook. So if you want to be able to eliminate an offensive threat from the Sun Devils, you need to get rid of Scadaboo and what he does, okay? My second key, Utah needs to go up-tempo on offense and allow for receivers to become a big part of the game. I mentioned how much it destroyed Utah's chances against Oregon, especially when it was working so well at the end of the first half. If you do that more consistently against ASU, I think that not only helps you in this game against the Sun Devils, it preps you for Washington, when I believe that the up-tempo offense will play an even bigger critical part in what Utah's trying to do on the offensive side of the ball. My third key to the game, you need to establish the run game early with physicality. With Jackson being injured week in and week out and Glover consistently low on production, this is the way. Physicality is the only way that Utah can establish this run game. And I think with, once again, the roster that ASU has on paper and the offensive line that Utah has on paper, they should be able to get this done. And if you're able to open up the run game, that allows for the second key to go up tempo on offense to thrive. My fourth key. You need to keep scoring every quarter, just like I said against Cal. Keep scoring consistent. You cannot get into a drought. ASU has proven that if you let them get back into this game, they will get into the game. They did that against USC. They clearly did that against Washington. They played a close game against Colorado and Cal. So Utah needs to complete all four of these keys. If they want to win at the score, I will now predict. If they do all four of these keys, I think they win 35-20, and I think this should be a great game despite the record of the Sun Devils. Okay, I'll go over these keys one more time before we end the episode. You need to eliminate Scadaboo on offense and hold him under 80 yards. Go up tempo on offense and allow for the receivers to be a part of the game. Establish the run game early with physicality and keep scoring every quarter. That's the key if Utah wants to win by multiple scores. That's it for this week's episode of The Thatcher Effect. Thank you all for listening. If you want to follow me on Twitter, make sure to follow me at NateThatcher15 or on Instagram at ThatcherEffectPodcast. Please make sure to also subscribe and follow the Variety Sports Network Collegiate on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll see you next week, and go Utes.